Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
And when it rains, you're shining down for me. And I just can't get enough. And I just can't get enough.
Rick Moody is one of those novelists who's comfortable writing nonfiction. Just don't get him started on drum machines. I'm John Schaefer, and today on Soundcheck, the author behind books like The Ice Storm and The Four Fingers of Death joins us with a new collection of essays about music, including a scathing manifesto about electronic drums. Thanks to the quartet known as So Percussion, the world no longer needs to wonder what an amplified cactus sounds like. Today, they'll look back at the musical adventures of the late composer John Cage, and they'll play live with some unusual instruments on Soundcheck after the news.
I know she's waiting just anticipating a thing. She'll never possess. No.
The author Rick Moody has a new book out. You'll want to play it loud. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. And when Rick Moody says soul music, he doesn't just mean Otis Redding. He'll explain why. And so Percussion joins us to explore the sound of the humble cactus live in our studio. Let's start, though, with Rick Moody, author of the best-selling novels like The Ice Storm and The Four Fingers of Death. Rick is also a songwriter and a member of the band The Wingdale Community Singers. His new book is a collection of his writing about music. It's called On Celestial Music, Adventures in Listening. And he joins us once again in our Soundcheck studio. Rick, welcome back.
Thanks, John. It's nice to be here.
You are, as many of your listeners and readers will know, a passionate music listener. You write, "I just can't stop." Why is that?
I mean, you would know as well as I, because you're the same way. We were just doing it before the microphone went on. I mean, it's just a condition, perhaps partly from growing up in the 70s when music was so central to youth culture, mm-hmm. In a way that was more pervasive than it is now. I just always had it on. I was always thinking about it. I was always arguing about it.
Were you always writing about it?
To some degree. I mean, I kept it to myself a little bit, and for a while the novelist impulse seemed to be the lead dog in the race, but it was always back there sort of waiting to assert itself.
Mm. What about as a novelist? I mean, was there always music on when you were writing? Did you take inspiration from that?
Totally, yeah. I mean, I could go through the books and say, and tell you what I was listening to almost for each section of each book.
And does listening to music make you write differently? I mean, sometimes you get the idea that someone uses the right word because it sounds better. You know, you have that sense of the inherent musicality of speech.
It's certainly the case that a great record can bring things out in you that you might not have otherwise come to. I mean, I can say the year that I discovered A Love Supreme, which was in my early 30s.
The John Coltrane
record.
Yeah,
it had a huge effect on the way I was thinking about prose. Just the way the solos worked and those long lines that Coltrane liked.
Now that's interesting because that, of course, is instrumental music.
Yeah.
So do lyrics get in the way?
Lyrics get in the way a little bit. Mm. At least now it's almost always instrumental music.
Rick Moody's new book is called On Celestial Music, and it is out now. And I want to ask you about the title because it gets us into the whole realm of the soul. And, of course, there is the genre of soul music. What do you mean by celestial music and music that has soul?
Well, somebody asked me, a friend of mine who's in the Episcopal Church world, was putting together this anthology of pieces about what heaven might look like. Because in the sort of mainline Episcopal world, this is something we don't talk about too often, and people were really loath to talk about it. So he thought to ask some writers he knew to attempt to tackle this. Big imaginative hurdle to get over, as you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
But so what was interesting to me, because I was writing so much about music at the time, was what would the music in heaven sound like, since a lot of scripture seems to indicate that there is music in heaven. what would we think it would sound like? And does it stagnate? For example, would the music in heaven be stuck back at the heavenly choir, or would it be allowed to have a pianist or
an electric guitar?
An electric guitar or something like that. So the further you get with the question, the more complex it gets. And so celestial music and soul music become not ways in, but very complicated attempts to try to figure out what we mean when we talk about so-called heavenly music.
Well, when we talk about so-called soul music, I mean, you focus on a number of pieces during the course of what is a fairly lengthy essay in this collection. And Otis Redding, you know, would certainly qualify as soul music in the secular sense. But what specifically is soulful about Otis Redding to you?
Well, there's so much to talk about with Otis Redding. I mean, yeah, he's soul music in the sense that when we say R&B and we use soul as a synonym for R&B, but I think anyone, any caller, anyone who will email into this show right now will agree that those performances are so electrifying that whatever it is we mean when we say soul music in the deeper sense, this is Exhibit A. I mean, you would say it about Aretha Franklin, too. Like, there's nothing about these performances in which that entire guy's spiritual life is not present at the moment that he sings what he sings. It's all there. And to me, that's soulful in some way.
And is it more easy to encounter that moving of the spirit in a live performance than in something that was created in the studio?
Well, I just think that Try a Little Tenderness didn't understand what the song was until they did it live. Then suddenly the performative aspect does enact this thing that the studio version never got to.
This is Otis Redding live in Paris and a little bit of Try a Little Tenderness. Otis Redding, live in Paris, Try a Little Tenderness, from the album The Stax Vault Review, Live in Paris, Volume 2. Rick Moody, in his new book called On Celestial Music, offering this up as a great example of soul music and of soul in music. And it's not just Otis. You hear it in his band, and especially in that audience.
Yeah, the audience is incredible, right? I mean, I was 6 at the time of that concert, and I so wish I had been there now, you know? I mean, didn't you want to get up and dance, John? You wanted to get up and dance.
Everything below the table was in constant motion. So, but, you know, that might be a perhaps obvious example of soulful music. It is soul music, after all. But you go on in this essay to other less immediately evident examples of what you consider to be celestial or soulful music. And among the examples that you give is Arvo Pärt, the Estonian composer, very popular in the classical music world for the past quarter century or so. This will not strike people the same way that Otis Redding does. But what do you hear that's similar?
I agree. It's the furthest opposite example almost that you could come up with. And yet I think a similar thing is happening. I mean, I think what Otis is trying to do is to transport us to a spot where the soul, if you will, the soul's yearning for being reunited with the infinite and so on is being enacted in some way. And the piece that I think I talked about in the Arvo Pärt piece, Fratres, that I talked about in the book, is similar. I mean, it's so still and so somber and so absolutely serious, but it's without virtuosity in a classical music sense. It's only about expression, and the expression is also of the soul's attempt to transcend the finiteness of what it is to be human here on earth. It's a longing for something deeper and more infinite.
Mm-hmm.
So they're similar.
Fratres is the name of the piece from the Estonian composer Arvo Pärt. Well, if Otis Redding's music was sweaty and exuberant and sensual, Arvo Pärt's music, Rick, is very serene and very kind of transparent, almost, but still soulful. There's still that kind of sense of the spirit. Is that what you're writing about in this essay?
Yeah, and also to me, in Pärt, you hear music as in its most... I mean, it's minimalist in the truest sense because it's so simple. I mean, if you saw it on the staff, that is not a terribly complicated piece, but it lets you into what it is that music does that human beings respond to so immediately and with such enthusiasm, which is the ability of music to say something about what we feel and who we are that we can't otherwise articulate, mm-hmm. you know, and that's that soulful quality.
We're speaking with the author, Rick Moody. His latest book, which is brand new, is called On Celestial Music and Other Adventures in Listening. You can catch Rick reading from the book in the Fort Greene area of Brooklyn this Wednesday at the Powerhouse Arena. And he'll be joined by musician and writer Wesley Stace. And then he'll be reading at McNally Jackson Books in Soho on Sunday, March 25th, here in New York. The book has lots of interesting essays that you've written over the course of many years now, going back to articles on Pete Townsend of The Who and The Lounge Lizards, a look at the word cool and its various musical associations. But there is a big essay on the drum machine, which takes this idea of the soul in music, and basically your question is, where is it? What have you done with my soul? What do you have against drum machines?
You know, it's so great that Soap Percussion's coming on after me because they're going to demonstrate how great live drumming is. I mean, the problem that I have with the drum machine in the sort of current iteration is that all the humanness gets taken out of how tempo is described and iterated in the music itself. So it just becomes too clean, too machine-like, and not terribly human. That's what happens.
And you sort of point a finger especially at Europe. I mean, there are drum machines here in America, too. Why does your essay begin with this sort of, like, you know, this question, drummers of Europe, why will you not, you know, enjoy the feeling of your hands upon the skins and
etc.? Well, because in Europe, they've seemed to... Somehow it got fused with the whole subgenre, which is sort of mopey goth rock. That's what happened in Europe. So it's as if they made an argument in defense of dehumanizing the music. Mm-hmm. That seems to me to be what Kraftwerk did. That's why they had the robots and they wanted to have the robots replace them at the concerts.
I want to challenge you a little bit on the Kraftwerk thing in just a minute, but... before we even get to Europe and the 1970s and 80s, you write about a kind of an unusual and striking example of this sort of metronomic, inhuman, rhythmic device in the music of Raymond Scott.
Yeah.
Who most of us know through Bugs Bunny cartoons.
That's how I know him first, too.
So you write about a song called TikTok from an album called Soothing Sounds for Baby. Yeah. What's going on here?
Well, Raymond Scott, I mean, he was an incredible artist. There's no disputing that. That he went from writing sort of amazing antic jazz music to being an early experimenter with synthesizers and drum machines is incredible. Mm-hmm. There's a person alive who did both those things is amazing. But so he made this album that was ostensibly music that was going to soothe baby, and he has this drum machine, basically plays this part for like 12 or 14 minutes, absolutely unvarying, unchanging, you know, metronomic perfection. And as far as I'm concerned, and I know that I'm about to have hell rain down on me, no baby on earth could possibly like this. I mean, it's so monotonous as to drive anyone insane.
All right. Listeners, baby or not, see what you think of TikTok from Raymond Scott. Is that really all there is to it?
That's all there is.
For 12 minutes?
Yeah, it goes on and on.
Maybe it's supposed to bore baby to sleep.
Bore baby to sleep. That might work.
So that's from the album Soothing Sounds for Baby, an early example of electronic music from Raymond Scott, much better known for his small ensemble jazz of the 1930s and 40s. He did that in 1964. Author Rick Moody has a beef with drum machines and the kind of metronomic robotic rhythms. You don't have a beef with what the Germans called Motorik, where a human drummer just does a very simple, basic, and repetitive drum pattern behind a band. Your beef is specifically when it's given to a machine.
Yeah. I mean, it's great when drummers do it because that just means they're really an amazing timekeeper. They're great drummers. I mean, that's fabulous, and there's some beauty to that, you know. But if it's just a machine, then you're taking away the possibility of expression. You just have what we just heard.
Yeah. You know? But are there instances where you thought it was a machine and it turned out to be just a guy really doing a very kind of very bare, spare, and very precise
Well, sometimes Neu sounds like that German band.
The German
Neu.
Band, yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know. I still find it beautiful then. The opposite is the more intriguing case when people do this all the time now because of this piece. People try to slip me up and they'll send me a track and say, I defy you to say whether it's live or sampled. But I can almost always tell. I have a really good record in that way.
All right. You mentioned Kraftwerk before. German band who, at the beginning, did have live drummers.
Yes.
And for many years now, I mean, you know, I can remember watching them do Autobahn on some TV show back in the 70s. It was just the four of them sitting behind a bank of instruments that had no bearing on anything I was familiar with, including the quote-unquote drummer who was just tapping what looked like pieces of tinfoil. I thought that was really cool.
No, I love that piece. I think that piece is great, actually, because they were coming up with different timbres for the percussion, but they were still sort of playing it.
Yeah.
And at that time, I felt like it was pretty interesting. But they sort of passed further down the road, as it were, and they no longer had a need for anybody to do anything as far as the drums were concerned.
But that sort of became part of the irony of Kraftwerk, you know, this kind of holding up a mirror to a society that was increasingly obsessed with the new and the technological and the robotic and stuff.
I agree with that, but you know, in the writing world, we refer to that as the fallacy of imitative form. If you imitate something repellent too successfully, you get a repellent result.
Mm. So the album The Man Machine, which was controversial for a number of reasons back in 1978,
right.
this would be an example of Kraftwerk going, this is a bridge too far for you.
Well, yeah. I mean, there are amusing moments for me in this album, but it starts to become a little bit too musically totalitarian.
Kraftwerk, The Man Machine.
YouTube video about that.
That's The Man Machine, Kraftwerk. Rick Moody, the author, here with me in the studio. You were just asking about, there's a YouTube video?
No, about the MoMA ticket situation for Kraftwerk.
I have not, but MoMA is doing a retrospective series of concerts of Kraftwerk.
For which I have no tickets. Do you have tickets to that?
I do not have tickets. Why? Are they sold out already?
You can't get any tickets to that.
Well, that's not surprising.
Yes.
Your feelings about Kraftwerk put you in a minority, it seems.
Sad but true. Yeah.
The Man Machine, an example of music made with drum machines, and you know, but everything there sounds mechanical. The voices, the vocoder voices and everything, it's deliberate, but still doesn't do it for you.
It's just not moving. There's nothing moving about it.
Rick Moody's new book is called On Celestial Music and Other Adventures in Listening. It covers a huge amount of ground and consists of essays that Rick has written over the years, although this one on the drum machine is a pretty recent one,
yeah,
right?
From last year.
And once again, Rick Moody will be reading from the book at the Powerhouse Arena in Brooklyn this Wednesday evening, March 21st, with musician and writer Wesley Stace joining him. And then Sunday here in Manhattan in Soho at the McNally Jackson Books on March 25th. And Rick, don't go far because we've got a pick three from you coming up in just a moment. Rick Moody has been my guest. You're listening to Soundcheck.
Passing stranger, you do not know how longingly I look upon you. You must be he I was seeking.
Hot off the presses, this is a brand new, not yet released song from Rick Moody from his band, the Wingdale Community Singers. In a moment, Rick will give us a mini playlist of his favorite music in our weekly feature, Pick 3. And coming up later, a journey into the soul of a cactus. The prickly plant is at the heart of a piece by the quartet known as So Percussion. They'll perform it, and they'll look back at the work of the late composer John Cage later on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. More now with Rick Moody, author, critic, songwriter, music lover, and the creator of this week's Pick 3 feature here on Soundcheck. And Rick, we're going to start with an album that's more than 30 years old. I mean, normally these Pick 3 features tend to be things that are current. Why this 30-year-old Michael Nyman record?
Well, they just re-released it. I mean, I guess Michael himself just re-released it because he has his own label now.
He's an English composer generally associated with the minimalist movement.
Indeed. He's the coiner of the term, I believe.
There are two claimants to that throne. There's Tom Johnson, a composer here in America, and yes, Michael Nyman over in England.
So this album, I think, is sort of the first Michael Nyman band album, although not named as such. It was just called Michael Nyman at the time, but it has the familiar lineup that we associate with the Michael Nyman band.
So big, colorful, lots of horns, that sort of thing.
Yeah, a lot of horns, and also a very kind of rock band vibe to it in terms of its rhythmic sound, I think.
Interesting that you go to the rock end, because the piece you picked actually features a couple of musicians who are far better known as jazz players.
Yeah, which is one reason why this track jumped off the album for me. It's really beautiful.
This is called Waltz, and it features the sax player Evan Parker and Peter Brutzmann with the Michael Nyman Band.
Thank you.
Newly reissued after 30 years, the English composer Michael Nyman and his waltz from the album is just called Michael Nyman, right?
Yep.
And featuring Evan Parker and Peter Brutzman, two remarkable kind of free jazz players here in a kind of minimalist setting. What an interesting combination.
I know, it's crazy. It's crazy and fabulous.
All right, a little more recent as we move on with Rick Moody's pick three, Brian Eno and this young English poet named Rick Holland. What are you, as a writer, responding to here? The music, the words?
Well, I love Eno. You and I both love Eno. I've loved Eno my whole adult life. But this album...
Well, I've loved Eno even longer
than
mine.
Yeah, and your life is longer than mine. But this album, to me, really, suddenly I got really excited about him again because he seemed to really solve the lyrical problem a little bit. The lyrics are great, dense, evocative, full of sort of strange dodges and moves that I find, suggestive in a literary way. So suddenly he was firing on all the cylinders for me, and the track I picked is a really good example of that. It's called Seed Pods, I think.
This is from the album Drums Between the Bells, Brian Eno and Rick Holland.
All over London, the clicker of seed pods against passing buses.
From the album Drums Between the Bells, a collaboration between the English composer and producer Brian Eno and the poet Rick Holland, that's called Seed Pods, and that is the second of the pick three for this week from author and musician Rick Moody. And you've picked for us already a couple of things from the other side of the Atlantic. One 30 years old, this one about a year old. Next... You're just back from South by Southwest, right?
Indeed, yes.
Where you discovered yet another English band.
Irish, actually, I think. Northern Irish. Well, maybe that makes them English in some way. Or you know, citizens
British,
of the United
anyway.
Kingdom.
Well, they're in London now.
Yeah.
They're called Django Django.
Django Django. I just heard about it from some people at South by Southwest. They said, I didn't see the show, but they said, this was great. You should look it up. I expected it to be dreadful, but I looked it up, and I was really... surprised and delighted by it. It's really strange and kind of new sounding.
The name Django Django, reference to Django Reinhardt, the great gypsy guitarist?
I assume as much, although you would totally not imagine that from hearing what you're about to hear.
The quartet, originally from Edinburgh, which would make them Scottish.
Scottish, indeed.
But based now in London, they were here in the States at South by Southwest Festival last week. This song's called Default.
We just lit the fire.
Django Django is the name of the band. Default is the name of the song. Rick, as far as we know, no record out yet?
I don't think there's a record out yet. No,
so
I think this is it.
All right.
We're ahead of the curve.
So Rick Moody's pick three for us this week, a reissue of Michael Nyman's 1981 self-titled record, the Brian Eno-Rick Holland collaboration, and this band called Django Django. And, of course, there's Rick's new book, On Celestial Music. Rick, so nice to see you again. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, John.
This is Soundcheck.
Take one for the team. You're a cog in the machine. It's like a default.
Still to come, the quartet So Percussion plays a piece in our studio by the late composer John Cage. You won't want to miss that next on Soundcheck.
Disappeared without a trace. You thought you'd set the bar. I never try to work it out. We just lit the fire, and now you wanna put it up again.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Since 1999, the quartet known as So Percussion has been traveling the world with its drums, its shakers, its tea sets, paint cans, beer kegs, and one very musical cactus. Like the late American composer John Cage, whose music you're hearing them play in the background, the four members of So Percussion believe that almost anything can be used to make music. And as if to prove the point, they are going to start us off with a piece that requires them to use, among other things, an old record player. This is a 1942 work by John Cage called Credo in Us, and it's a live performance by So Percussion.
We're going to have this afternoon and present her with this beautiful corsage. But first let me say it's wonderful to see this turn out, because as you know, our organization stands for the better things in art.
That is just an excerpt from the John Cage 1942 composition called Credo in Us, in which Cage confounded all the purists by scoring the piece for live instruments and musicians and radio and phonograph. And you've just heard So Percussion performing live here in the studio. So Percussion is Jason Truding, who joins me at the microphone. Jason, welcome.
Hello.
Adam Slewinski, who makes his way from the piano. Hi, Adam.
Hi.
Josh Quillen was your DJ.
Yes.
He was manning the turntable there. I love the Anna Russell at the very end there. What a great way.
Surprised us all.
Yeah. Anna Russell, great comedian of the mid-20th century who, you know, her subject matter was often classical music. So. And Eric Beach, who played percussion and the annoying buzzer sound.
Perfectly annoying.
Yeah. So, Jason, what do you suppose Cage was up to here with, you know, specifically asking you and anyone else performing this piece to incorporate other people's music and sounds into it?
Yeah, I think it's complex. And I think the more we've dealt with it, the more complex that question becomes. I think he wrote the piece in 42. Obviously, a lot of stuff happening in 42. And I think it was, in a certain way, you know, him, you know, raising questions about what it means. It was a credo. So what it means to be an American and what it means. There's us and credo in U.S. So I think it was questions there, but it also was questions about the music world and what it meant. When he wrote the score, and I heard you say this when we walked in, that he kind of asked you to use European classical music. And so for him, there was that dialogue of what does it mean to put on Beethoven and then to cover it up with tin cans.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's an interesting dialogue still, but I think the more we've played it, you know, Josh really switches it up, his part, DJing.
So no two performances of Credo in Us, or Credo in U.S., if you want to pronounce it that way, have ever been the same.
No, I think, yeah, no two performances have ever been the same. And then we've really been challenging ourselves, the more we tour this piece, to really go different directions with it. And what does it mean when you start with Shostakovich? What does it mean when you start with Bon Jovi? What does it mean when you start with the national anthem? You know, what does it mean when you're covering up something pretty blatantly? And I think that dialogue is interesting to us, but the dialogue is different every night for us.
Now, John Cage, Adam, we're celebrating his 100th birthday this year.
This year in September.
September.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there's this big American Maverick series that you guys are a part of. How central was Cage to you guys? I mean, for percussionists, he's sort of the beginning of the major body of American repertoire.
100% central. And the way we've been talking about it some recently is this analogy of saying, you know, if you think of Haydn maybe as the grandfather of the string quartet, I think to us, thinking of Cage as the grandfather of the percussion tradition, maybe for us, Steve Reich might be the father. You know, these are those two guys as American composers are two central people to our tradition. And there's a funny thing where sometimes when you're going around talking to people about Cage and about 433 and stuff, they're like, oh yeah, that's the guy that did that thing. They think
the
of him
silent
as,
piece.
Yeah.
4 minutes and 33
right,
seconds.
Right, that happened to have been 4 minutes, 33 seconds at his first performance. Yeah. And, you know, people look at it as kind of this fringe and this sort of marginal and very crazy, wacky thing. If you're a percussionist, Cage is your old master, which is a funny term to apply to a guy like him. But he actually stands at the very middle, the very center of what we do. And the excerpt you were playing earlier from Third Construction is this unbelievable piece of written out chamber music that we love, that we've been playing for years. But throughout his career, he went all the way from that kind of very expressive rhythmic chamber music to very, very abstract pieces using chance procedures to figure out the musical form. And actually, Credo was the very first piece he ever wrote that had any chance procedures in it, because maybe not procedures to write the piece, but the radio element, the phonograph element, is a sort of random element in the piece.
In fact, when he wrote the piece in 1942, the U.S. had entered the war in the wake of Pearl Harbor, and his directions for the radio, the use of the radio in the piece, were to find a music channel of some form or another, not a news channel, in case there was a national emergency.
Wow.
So,
wow.
So a little, you know, a little bit of reality intruding on what we think of as like the ivory tower world that, that Cage lived in. Now, guys, you are performing at Zankel Hall on Monday night, a week from tonight, as part of this American Mavericks series. And it's a program that features that work and other pieces by Cage and related works. But it also features, Jason, the electronic artists Matmos and Dan Deacon. Is Cage
he's kind of an influential figure in that world too, isn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, for sure. Actually, and I'm not even sure we thought of it so to make that blatant connection, but I think that's true. Early on, he said percussion was revolution. He said that in the 30s sometime. And I think what he pictured throughout his life was that music was going more and more towards using electronics and using new sounds. And when we've worked with both these artists, it's been amazing to see how much grounding they find in that tradition. Mm-hmm. And with our goal being of putting together a show that was going to celebrate Cage, but instead of kind of as a, you know, reconstruction of, you know, these wonderful works, but to celebrate it in a pretty living way, we kind of did the half Cage music and then half other. And it just happened that these, you know, these collaborations fit perfectly into that for us and then for them as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah.
Because this American Maverick series is suggesting, as others have suggested before, that there is a tradition of American Maverick composers, which would seem like a contradiction in terms, Adam. I mean, if you're a maverick, you're not a part of a tradition, and yet it somehow seems to work.
Our good friend Steve Mackey calls it the American crackpot tradition. And we absolutely love that, because there is a sort of freewheeling spirit of invention and sort of casting out on your own to find new ideas that we love. You know, Cage's father was an inventor. He had a patent on a submarine and was like kind of a crackpot inventor himself. And so the combination of like somehow studying composition with Arnold Schoenberg, but then also having this father who taught him all about like coming up with new ideas, maybe seems to have been part of his makeup.
Mm-hmm. And Jason, do you guys in So Percussion see yourselves as part of that crackpot / maverick tradition?
I was going to say, we proudly see ourselves there. I can only hope that other people kind of place us there. I think, yeah, in doing this project, we've really seen our lineage going through these mm-hmm. crackpots of sorts.
Well, you know, some people might see the sight of a couple of percussionists surrounding a cactus plant and playing it as a kind of a crackpot endeavor.
I don't understand what you're saying. You see that as somehow strange?
Wait, what?
Yeah, we've been doing it too long, I guess.
Now, Cage did this himself.
Yeah.
But you guys have done this piece called Needles, which you recorded actually with Matmos. But you've worked up what, like kind of a duo version
us? We've been touring a duo version, and we're happy that Matmos is going to be joining us on stage at
Zenkel.
Mm-hmm. We've been doing all different versions, and this is some live cactus playing, and some Drew from Matmos made a bunch of kind of material for the piece as well.
How do you play a cactus?
Carefully. Very carefully.
Room full of percussionists, yeah. And I have to provide the rim shot. Come on.
We're slow. We traditionally use a ball cactus, John, uh-huh. And the tines, you know, you kind of go down and you're okay, and you try to pluck up and you're going to run into trouble.
And that's
when blood spills. Okay. And we've all gotten pretty good at it. We made this piece straight up as an homage to Cage's childhood tree.
Which is his flower based piece.
Absolutely, yeah. I think it's amplified plant material that just traditionally everybody starts with a cactus. And so we kind of made this piece as a shout out of sorts. And the original cactus's name was Murray. May he rest in peace. That Murray was in B flat major. Just all the samples we got from him was very B flat. So the chords you'll hear are slowed down Murray to give you this kind of B flat, E flat thing happening.
What's
on
this
the top
cactus's name?
Steven, didn't we say?
That's so boring. It probably is. We've gone through a few.
All right. Well, who's playing this?
Jason and Eric.
Me and Eric. Yeah, we're going to do a version. Yeah.
All right. This is called Needles from the guys in So Percussion. And it is part of their concert performance next Monday night. You can actually see this live in action at Zenkel Hall at 7:30 on a program called We Are All Going in Different Directions, a John Cage celebration. The American Maverick series continues through March 30th at Carnegie. And our sister station, WQXR's digital stream, Q2Music.org, is producing a companion series to American Mavericks with guest hosts and playlists from people like David Byrne and archival interviews. And you can find a full schedule of events on our webpage, WNYC.org/soundcheck. Here now, with Cactus in Hand, So Percussion, and Needles. Thank you. That, believe it or not, is a live performance of music for Cactus and Electronics from So Percussion, and it's called Needles. It is part of the program that So Percussion are doing next Monday night at Sankel Hall as part of the American Maverick series, a John Cage celebration. This their tribute to John Cage. Guys, thank you so much for joining us in the studio.
Thanks,
great
John.
To see you.
Thanks for having us.
And that's going to do it for Soundcheck today. Coming up tomorrow, the accordion. It's the Rodney Dangerfield of musical instruments. I tell you, don't get no respect. We'll hear about the rise and fall and the scrappy comeback of the squeeze box. Plus, Daniel Rawson of the band Grizzly Bear plays songs from his debut solo EP. Our technical director is Irene Trudell, the program produced by Katie Bishop and Greta Cohn. Our senior producer is Joel Meyer. Our engineer today, Paul Schneider. We had help from Ellen Walkington. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.